Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As this year's elections become more of a merger between a casino and a circus, with billionaire ringmasters offering a competing clown show, we will begin with a discussion about who really runs our country and the world. The CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine, David Rothkopf, joins us to talk about his new book, Power Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government, and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. Then we will visit the graveyard of empires, Afghanistan, and discuss the accelerated withdrawal of the U.S. out of one war as pressure builds to get us embroiled in another. Former National Security Staffer Roger Morris, who has written Between the Graves, a history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents, joins us to look into the latest chapter of America's recent foreign policy misadventures. Then finally, we'll get an update on the surrogate war in Syria, where the Russians and the Iranians, who have been pouring in arms to support the Assad dictatorship, appear to be winning, while the Saudis, in spite of their mountains of money and arms, seem to be backing the losing side. James Gelvin, a specialist on Syria at UCLA, joins us to assess why, as it appears that the Syrian opposition has been routed, does the Obama administration keep insisting Assad will fall? And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book just out is Power Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Nice to be back.
And the gravity of your book and the reckoning that lies ahead, I must say, is in stark contrast to the sort of game show democracy that we're witnessing here in this presidential cycle with promises of $2 gasoline. It's enough to make you tear your hair out, the gap between the challenges and those that are stepping up to the plate.
Well, I think on one level, the political debate in the U.S. has been debased by what you correctly refer to as a kind of a shift to a game show mentality. It's all a cage match. Things are said for their emotional effect. Things are said so that they stir up the Twitterverse. The extreme superficial ideas really dominate the discussion. I think on another level, though, it's even more pernicious because the people who are driving this are not shallow people. They're people with deep pockets and big checkbooks who are directing the conversation in these shallow directions in order to, in some cases subtly and in some cases directly, advance very clear self-interest.
Well, it's inextricably bound in your new book, Power Inc., David Rothkopf, as a sort of subtext for why we can't advance and why there can't be an alliance or a cooperation between government and industry. The problem is that industry or corporations own the government, and they've owned it through the lack of campaign finance reform, and in fact the reversal with the Supreme Court decision. I mean, we could never in this country deal seriously with the great global challenge of global warming until there's some campaign finance reform, surely.
Well, look, we can't deal successfully with most of the problems we face unless public power and private power are in the right balance. And in fact, throughout most of American history, contrary to the political debate you hear about getting rid of government, our big achievements, canals, railroads, the internet, the space program, highways, a lot of tech advancements, have been through public-private partnership. But sometimes, and recently, over the course of the past several decades, what happens is private power becomes so concentrated that it's able to change the rules in the system, put a heavy thumb on the scale, and instead of government balancing private power on behalf of the people at large, it actually works to advance the interests of a few. Our system is so fundamentally corrupt in terms of the role money plays in it, which is different from any other country in the world, that right now, even prior to the advent of super PACs, we are having the rich determine who the candidates are in both parties and what the agenda is going to be. And we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg with the super PACs. What if this election is close come October? What if they don't have money? What are the parties going to do? They're going to turn to a handful of people for a bunch of big checks. And if you don't think there's a quid pro quo involved in that kind of a transaction, you're not paying attention. Even Barack Obama, who you might see as the advocate against this kind of a movement, has a track record where half of the big bundlers in his campaign have ended up with senior political positions in the United States government.
Well, there is this phenomenon referred to as government sacks, and there was, of course, this cri de coeur from the Goldman Sachs executive who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that's been getting some attention. It's an extraordinary plea, if you will, and he's basically saying, you know, that it's completely morally corrupt and the environment is toxic. And I think they could extend that to Wall Street, given that, you know, Wall Street is, according to some of the analysts I've spoken to in the oil and gas field, say they're responsible for 30% of the cost of gasoline, which is completely unproductive and hurting the consumer and hurting the recovery. But not to belabor the contrast between that reality and the political debate, you know, we're having this debate about personal morality as opposed to public morality.
Well, exactly. And the personal debate is a distraction, you know, in its best case. In some cases, it's more pernicious than that. I personally, you know, am a little skeptical of Goldman Sachs employees who've been there for a dozen years and all of a sudden have a bad outbreak of conscience, as if somehow the morality within Goldman Sachs has changed dramatically in the course of the past several months. It clearly hasn't. Over the course of the past several decades, we see the way the system works and the way that Wall Street worked the last crisis. During the Clinton administration, which I served, they said, get off our backs, let us do our thing, let markets take the lead. And we, for whatever reason, and I think we were naive in this, said, okay, we took down Glass-Steagall, they took the lead. And as always happens in markets throughout history, they overreached, and there was a crisis. And the phone rang in Washington, and they said, you know how we wanted you off our backs? Maybe not so much. Could you help us out here? We could use a little bit of bigger government right now. Then they took the check, and to really show that they had power, once that check cleared, they got back up on their hind legs. They called back, and they said, you know what? We'd like you off our backs again. And government got off their backs again. The financial reforms that we've had were a sham. We haven't funded the agencies that are supposed to do the oversight so they could do the oversight in that reform. They're more too big to fail banks today than there were before. The global derivative markets are bigger and riskier than they were before. In other words, the big issues remain. Homeowners have not had their problems addressed, and Wall Street's making record profits. So that is a real sort of case study in how money can co-opt the system, and government cannot serve the interests of the public at large, which is actually its role.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine and the author of this new book, Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. And before we get into the different forms of capitalism in the world and the competition and where the U.S. stands vis-a-vis China, India, Brazil, etc., just to finish up on this, it seems to me that inherent in this problem where you have, you know, a kind of the power of the oligarchs and a corporate plutonomy, if you will, over a corrupted democracy, it would seem that there's also an attitude surely on the part of the super wealthy, the very ones that are putting the money into these super PACs at the moment and determining our political fate. Isn't there a problem here in as much as these titans of industry, whether they're the inheritors like the Koch brothers or the self-made men like Adelson and others, don't they see politicians as political hirelings, that they therefore don't want talented people in politics?
Yeah, I think, look, right now we're seeing globally the leadership failure that has been bought and paid for by elites that don't want particularly strong leaders. You know, there is this kind of subtext that you hear in the political debate. Ron Paul and other people will say it more clearly than others, and they'll say, oh, let's get government out of the way. Let's push back government. If we have smaller government, we, you know, liberty will sweep in. Freedom will follow in its place. But of course, that's not what happens. When government comes out of the way, you create a vacuum, and politics abhors a vacuum just like nature does. And what comes in are the empowered big actors who can take advantage of that vacuum. So when the Kochs write a check and say, we want small government, they ostensibly are advocating liberty for the average guy, but really what they're doing is advocating elbow room for big private interests to do what they want without regulation, without oversight, and without the public having a seat at the table about the economic and social future of the United States.
Well, it's breathtakingly cynical, but nevertheless effective, how in helping fund the Tea Party, they've got this so-called populist movement that's carrying the water for the oligarchy.
Well, it is breathtakingly cynical, although on some level it's just simple self-interest at work. Corporations, private actors are legally obligated to go and serve their shareholders and maximize profits and push back on things that constrain profits. Now, having said that, when people in the Tea Party who are angry at being exploited, are angry at a system where the 99% are not benefiting, angry at a system where even last year, of the first year of this most recent recovery, 93% of the benefits went to the top 1% of the people, they're supporting something that they think is actually going to alleviate their circumstances, and it's not. What it's going to do is it's going to make it worse, and it's going to continue the trends that over the course of the past decade have made it the first in American history where we lost net jobs, in which social inequality got worse, in which income, social mobility went down. We're in a dire situation in which the system is not working the way that it's supposed to nationally, and it's compounded by the fact that on the global stage, in some cases, this power imbalance is even worse.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine and the author of the new book just out, Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. Now, it does seem as something of an irony that the United States, after World War II, when it was pretty much the last man standing and pretty much unscathed, except arguably for Hawaii, you had the Japanese and the Germans were defeated, but the U.S. brought them back and in many ways gave them the kind of institutions or the government, the private-public relationship that in many ways you're arguing about here, David Rothkopf. I mean, there's no question that the Japanese private-public model, and to some extent the Korean, all the way through the so-called Tigers, have proven very successful. And the German model, where unions have seats on the boards of directors, have made that one of the world's most successful, if not the world's most successful, export economy. So what happened here? What's good for our rivals is not good for us? That we export a better system than the one we have at home?
Well, first of all, those systems are colored by their culture and key questions that are asked within the context of that culture. What is community? Why do we have government? Why do we serve one another? What are our goals? In some respects, you know, they had an advantage. They no longer were mesmerized, as we have been recently, with the idea of being number one, being the most powerful nation on earth, and they could focus instead. They weren't also, you know, caught up in the kind of funding the defense beast as we have been caught up in it, and they were able to focus on what do we do to improve quality of life, what do we do to improve the people at large, how do we do this in the context of our culture. We, on the other hand, bought into this notion that in order to be successful, we must be the biggest, most powerful nation on earth, that we must spend the most on defense. And then we bought into this notion that small government, deregulation, pushing back, and leaving it to the markets was really the thing that was working for us, even though in 200 years of American history, that's actually not the case. And from the 1980s and Reagan and Thatcher, Anglo-American capitalism started putting out a notion that if we just lowered taxes, pushed government out of the way, reduced regulation, that everybody would prosper. Except we now have several decades of looking at this. That's not what happens. And then there was a twist. The Cold War ended, and at the end of the Cold War, we were celebrating our victory over, you know, communism, and we thought the competition was over, but a new competition was starting between systems, such as the ones that you've mentioned, and ours, competition among capitalism's alternative models. And today, you've got capitalism with Chinese characteristics, you've got European capitalism, very different in the South and in the North of Europe. You've got democratic development capitalism in big countries like India and Brazil. You've got small states that are very entrepreneurial, like Singapore or Israel or the United Arab Emirates, that act a lot like countries more than they do like, I mean, companies more than they do like countries. And so what you've ended up with here is a lot of other versions, and all of them have a bigger role for government in ensuring competitiveness, and a bigger role for government in providing a safety net, and a bigger role for government in empowering people to succeed than we do. In fact, none of them are having the kind of extremist debates that we have in the U.S., where people credibly stand up and say, we shouldn't have government, we shouldn't have public education, we shouldn't have an EPA, we shouldn't have regulation. These thoughts would never even cross their minds.
But in terms of the trajectory of the U.S. since World War II, is it a case that the empire has taken over the republic, or at least, you know, the republic is being threatened by the empire? Is it that simple?
Well, I don't think it's that simple, but I think that's certainly the case. I mean, you know, look, if you look out over the course of the past several decades of American history, we've collectively made a choice. Perhaps not consciously, but if you look at democracy and you're a historian in 200 years determining what our choices were through our democratic system, we've decided that we are going to take the majority of the discretionary resources that we've got, that is everything that, you know, isn't tied up in an entitlement, and the biggest chunk of that, year after year after year, we're going to invest in defense. We're going to invest in spending more money on the military than every other major power in the world added up. Well, that's a choice. And it means we're not going to spend it on education or health care or highways or improving opportunities for the poor or taking care of the elderly. We're going to devote it on power and not on leadership. And I think that that is a choice that ultimately is costing us greatly.
So, David Rothkopf, do you think that could be reversed in terms of some kind of political leadership or somebody stepping up and creating this platform? Because one of the things I find sort of pernicious and depressing about all of this is, as you've described it, the decline of our standard of living and our quality of life at the expense of being the global superpower. What's happened is a kind of public relations injection of jingoism to distract us from these realities. So we have a phony patriotism that tells us how we're doing so great, when in reality we're not. Is there any possibility that we can have a kind of national referendum about what it really means to be an American? What going back to that, when I was talking earlier about public morality versus private morality, you know, a kind of reality check on where we stand?
First of all, I certainly think there's some encouraging signs. First of all, the United States is a country where the Constitution was brilliantly conceived of in order to enable us to reinvent ourselves. And we've done it in sweeping ways. 100 years ago, we were an agrarian country. 100 years later, we were an industrial country. We were a rural country. We became an urban country. We were an uneducated country. We became the world leader in higher education. We have reinvented ourselves regularly, so there's no reason why we couldn't do it again. Secondly, you know, there have been some encouraging subtexts in the U.S. political debate, whether it's the Occupy movement and the Tea Party at least starting to express the politics of alienation and say, no, we can't have this system go on, or Barack Obama saying the election's going to be about fairness, or Mitt Romney saying the election's going to be a debate about capitalism. You know, you could have two fairly reasonable, moderate candidates having a discussion about this issue in a fairly substantive way if it turns out in a certain kind of way. That said, neither Mitt Romney nor Barack Obama is going to be the change agent this system needs. We are one crisis shy of clarity about what we need to do, whether it's in the national level in terms of rebalancing power, or at the global level in terms of saying, look, you know, there are a couple thousand corporations out there that are better able to operate on the global stage than most companies and countries, and we don't have the regulatory and counterbalancing mechanisms on the global stage that we do within nations, and we can't project the ones that we've got within our borders out onto the global stage. And that creates a real problem when so many of the fundamental issues in the social contract require global decisions and global action in order to be fulfilled. So the ability to make change is there. But I don't see the impetus towards, you know, a game changer, HBO movies aside, that we really, you know, that we really need to have. And in fact, I think one of the ironies of that HBO movie game change is that it was not about a game change. It was about the same old game. It was about money winning the debate. It was about the candidate with the most money from Wall Street, beating the candidate who didn't quite have as much money. Our country in sore need of a game change, that's for sure.
Right. And also it's about a debate that's not driven by facts and data, but by ideology and spin. And, you know, gone are the days when William F. Buckley debated his good friend George McGovern.
Well, gone are the days, you know, look, you know, I wrote a book that's a history because I wanted to look back and I wanted to say how much of this is a historical trend. And because that's going to mean, you know, we will understand how hard it is to change. And in fact, many of these things have been afoot for a long time. The empowerment of companies, artificial persons, to the point that they now have essentially the inalienable rights of human beings and then some, because they're immortal, bigger, better able to operate globally. The Supreme Court keeps endowing them with more and more rights and prerogatives. This is a bigger issue that's about how society is organized, and whether it's during the Glorious Revolution in England, or the American Revolution, the French Revolution, 1848, even earlier in the 20th century, there were debates about what kind of society we wanted to have, why we were organized this way. Was it about being number one, or was it about offering a better quality of life to people? We need to get back to that debate first. We need to figure out what kind of society we want to be, and then shape the system to serve that objective, rather than allowing the system to be shaped by people who are serving their self-interest.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, David Rothkopf.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, we barely scratched the surface with your book, so all the more reason for people to get it, because there's an awful lot of original thought and ideas, and I congratulate you on it.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine. He is the author of a number of books. His latest just out is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. I'm going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the graveyard of empires, Afghanistan.